Tell me the history of Bitcoin
Oh, I don't know if we have enough time for that.
maximalism. I have lived through it, and I'm pretty sure someone who actually researched that period. I'm wondering what kind of things I did not notice. But yeah, it would be a nice story, I think.
It's sociological phenomenon, which is not my forte, but like you said, we've lived through it and now we're just trying to understand it and explain it and hopefully be able to get some sort of idea of where it's going from here. But I think it's always going to be evolving and we're going to be surprised by which, new factions rise and fall over the years.
So you wrote an article about it, right? You just recently retweeted it. What's that about?
I think the gist of it is that it has natural logical beginnings and evolutions over the years of how we've ended up where we are today. Basically, that it really spawned off of the first era of altcoins, which were just, Bitcoin with a few parameters tweaked. And that's when the concept of shitcoin really arose, in that, oh, you're just making a knockoff of Bitcoin that has, no meaningful additional utility or value. And then it's all just marketing, of you trying to accrue value and compete with the Bitcoin network. But over the years, the whole altcoin space has exploded, gotten a lot more sophisticated. Yes, I would say the vast majority of them are, cheap pump and dump scams, but there are some projects out there that are actually putting in work and trying to do novel things. And some, faction of Bitcoiners prefer to just remain, focused on Bitcoin and automatically dismiss all other attempts at doing anything with cryptography in this space. So it has become, I think, more and more of a virtue signaling type of issue. Of saying, we're not even going to give other projects the time of day because we believe that in some sense or another, it's competing with Bitcoin, whether that's for the, monetary value or just time and attention value. And, Bitcoin is the only thing worth spending any resources on. So it seems like it's turned into less of a interesting, like, technical debate of whether or not any of these projects are doing interesting new things, and more of ideological debate. And those ideological factions have, in some cases, become more and more extreme as new cohorts come in. And I think this is a natural result of, self-selection and narratives and memetics evolving over the years. It's not unlike any other sort of cultural or even religious narratives. And you can even go back in history and look at different religions and how they've forked off over centuries and millennia. So I think that this was naturally going to happen. And it's just a question of, how do we approach it? Are you going to fight against it or just say, hey, this is human sociology and, call it out for what it is, and you can choose to participate in, whatever narratives and ideology you want.
There are actually some more practical things here, other than sociology here, because I noticed when over the years I created or moderated different Bitcoin cryptocurrency related groups, and I'm a busy person. I'm doing this as a hobby and stuff, and you just have I am a I'm a shitcoiner. I don't really touch shitcoins, but I'm not against them. I hope they can come up with something great. But you know, I have to make the judgment calls, and I cannot review every single post there. So if it's altcoin, like I just gonna guess and delete right away and get on with my day. So that was my experience, at least. Even though I didn't want to push Bitcoin maximalism, I am pushing it. I have another very interesting question for you. So, as you know, I am a privacy researcher for 10 years at this point. And as I recall, you have had some privacy problems back in the day. Can you tell me about that? What happened?
Right. So, my privacy journey is interesting because it's really flipped around over the decades. In my early career, before I went full time building Bitcoin and self-custody systems, I actually spent a decade as an email engineer at a marketing company. And specifically, over the years, I went from being more of a front-end developer to being more of a back-end large data analysis engineer. So this was like the early days of cloud computing in the late 2000s when it was just becoming a thing of what, cloud even was. And so essentially, I was one of the guys responsible for, stripping away people's privacy in a sense, because my task was to take petabytes and petabytes of raw analytics information that was getting collected as a result of the emails that were being sent out and opened and clicked on and tracked in a variety of different ways, and to basically use our large scale distributed data systems to analyze that data and provide metrics, analytics, and even sort of predictive algorithms that we could then sell to marketers so that they could basically more efficiently target and sell whatever they were trying to sell to, the people who were most likely to buy whatever they were trying to sell. So, that gave me a lot of insight into just how poor your privacy is on a day-to-day basis of using the internet and the sort of default setup that people do. And after I had been in Bitcoin working for a couple of years and started to accrue a number of followers on Twitter and piss people off during the scaling debates, I ended up getting visited by a SWAT team. They shut down my entire neighborhood of like 400 houses at the time because someone decided that they wanted to screw with me and extort me. And that really led me to realize how exposed I was physically, not just from a digital sense, but like people could actually physically find me and, try to threaten and harm me. So it took me about a year after that incident of researching.
Can you slow down for a moment there?
Sure.
Like, what happened exactly? So SWAT team went to your house, you were home, you were not home, your family. Well, what's going on there?
I was kind of lucky when it actually happened because I had some slight operational security practices in that, for example, when I would post something with a photo or a location, I would only do that after I had already left that location. And in other times, I would post things that people might then assume that I was doing something. So, for example, what happened on this day, it was a Monday morning. And I got up and I went to the gym as my routine was to do, usually around 6 o'clock in the morning. And as soon as I got to the gym, I tweeted something about how it was, Monday morning. We had a whole other week of, scaling, debate, arguing ahead of us. And went and I did my workout, showered, came back to my house, and I ran into a police blockade trying to get back into my neighborhood. And so it took probably 20 or 30 minutes of me sitting there and then eventually, talking to the police more of understanding, what this sort of active shooter incident was until we realized that I was the active shooter that they were looking for. And, thankfully was able to explain what was going on of like, I knew what swatting was. I just, never thought it was going to happen to me. And, what had happened was, of course, the attacker saw my tweet and assumed, it's so early in the morning, I must have just gotten out of bed, I must still be at home. And so I was lucky from that sense that I actually ran into the police, not inside of my home, as opposed to them busting down the door with guns and being, hair trigger. Something could have gone wrong, if myself as a firearm owner who actually at the time had about a dozen rifles laid out in my living room because I had been to the shooting range the previous day and I was planning on cleaning my guns. It could have been, a nasty ending, if not for that one particular little tidbit of me posting when I wasn't at home. But yeah, this was a wake-up call. It could have gone worse, and I wanted to prevent it from happening again. And that's when I really started going down the privacy rabbit hole.
And what did you do? Go to another place, leave another place, not posting about it anymore, not telling
Well,
friends
yeah,
and family
so
to not take pictures there.
yeah, there were, a couple of different paths in front of me. I could have just, deleted my Twitter account, deleted all of my online presence and gone underground and basically no longer presented myself as a public persona that could be targeted. But I didn't want to throw away the reputation that I already built for many years under my real name. So I decided to take what is arguably a much harder path. And that was basically, how do I continue using my government name, but in such a way that I cannot be targeted by just any random person who, spends $20 or $30 going to, one of the various data brokerages and name lookup services and be able to, find all of my like credit information and other personal information to then, target my actual house. And, the only way that I really found that that was possible was to burn down every publicly registered thing that was associated with me. So, in the United States, we call it real property, but that's things like your house and your vehicle, large value assets that get publicly registered and create a lot of records that then, of course, get sucked into various databases. So basically, yeah, I had to move to a different place. I had to sell all of my assets that were, tied to my name, all my physical assets. And then I had to purchase new assets, but not under my own name. I had to create, legal trusts and corporations and structure them in such a way that my name is not on any of the publicly registered documents. So, any assets that I have are just under various innocuous sounding corporations and trusts that hopefully no one would be able to associate with me because those names are not associated with me in any other way. And the short version of it is I had to sort of look at every aspect of my life, like everything that could be used to connect to me, things like phone numbers, for example, and basically set up proxies. So, a proxy, you generally think of a proxy in sort of a technical sense of like, oh, I'm gonna set up a proxy server that's basically rerouting traffic. But you can have proxies in a variety of different ways. So, for example, I consider like even these legal entities as sort of proxies. They're basically obfuscating, the true ownership of assets. For phone numbers, I have proxies where it's basically, I have multiple SIM cards, but I don't even know the phone numbers associated with those SIM cards. I have a sort of ring of proxy voice over IP numbers that sit in front of them that are the numbers I actually give out to various people and services, and then those, forward the calls along. And I can rotate these out as needed. I can spool up new ones to create, essentially new pseudonyms as needed, and firewall off the different aspects of my life. And then, even like using attorneys, friends, family as proxies for other aspects, it gets really complicated, and I would say that in that first year, I spent tens of thousands of dollars in legal fees mostly to set all of this stuff up. And it is still an ongoing cost, thousands of dollars a year at the minimum, just to keep the corporations and the trusts going and to pay for additional services that otherwise, most people would not be using.
I might have ended up in a similar situation regarding the Samurai people. They have been sending me death threats since forever, right? But the last habit that they get into is to keep posting my parents' address. I suspect that they think that that's my address, but I'm not sure. I mean. Anyway, so they kept posting it, and it got to a point where TDev have my parents' address was his Twitter location, right? So it's like holy fucking shit. But anyway, they got in jail, so no need to go to the extent that you
Yeah, I
did.
mean, that is another sort of issue of, even if you set up all of this amazing privacy for yourself, it's highly unlikely that you will convince your extended family or other people who are associated with you to do the same. And, you can't protect everybody, unfortunately.
All right. So this series is about Bitcoin and health. The reason is because I started a Rejuvenation Olympics interview series. So that's about people trying to slow down their aging. And I felt like I'm moving too far away from Bitcoin, and somehow maybe I could bring the two together and see. Find some Bitcoiners who did something quite significant in health. And I recalled you had an article back in the day called Fat to Fit. And I would like to talk about that. But I would also be curious what happened since then. So let me set the stage. A couple of years ago, you went down from, I translated it to Europeans, so don't worry, from 94 kilogram to 79 kilogram, 34 body fat percentage to 21 body fat percentage, and 114 centimeter waist circumference to 90 centimeter, and all this in 4 months. Now, I think 34 body fat percentage to 21 body fat percentage in 4 months is the crazy number here for me. And 1 year later, you still kept it. So tell me about that. How did it came about?
Well, it started in the middle of COVID lockdowns. It was probably like 6 to 8 months into the COVID saga. So, late 2020, I started thinking, how do I protect myself from COVID? And when I looked at the various mortality metrics, it seemed to me like the biggest issue that you had to worry about in terms of like comorbidity is just obesity. The people who were essentially, suffocating to death as a result of having, lung deterioration with COVID, seemed like a lot of them were either, extremely elderly and frail, or they were just extremely overweight. And so, I wasn't elderly, but I knew I was overweight, and I figured the most proactive thing that I could do would be just, improve my overall health there so that if and when I contracted COVID, my body would be in a better position to fight it off. And so that's when I started looking into, okay, how do I actually do this with as least effort as possible? That was my other thing is, I didn't want to go crazy on having to spend a ton of time, counting calories and tracking a lot of things. And so I think that was the main impetus of, how do I do this as easily as possible? And, we can get into, I guess, whether or not it really is low effort or easy, but some of my own, I guess quirks allow me to be a bit more extreme in some of my habits than maybe the average person, so that helped. But I think it came down to simplicity as well as what's the most straightforward, simple way to improve my health or at least reduce my fat. And so that was my primary goal for that first period, and then over the years, I've started experimenting with other things, trying to continue to improve my health in other ways.
I noticed that obesity is it seems to be honest. You have some really nasty vices. Obesity is the single thing that one can do to lower their biological age. That's interesting. Even I might even go that far to say even more than working out. But then the variables start to confound. So what's the simplest, least effort way to lose a lot of fat? Tell us. Can't wait.
Yeah, so I think a lot of it has more to do with cutting out bad things from the first sort of quip that you may hear a lot that I think is actually quite accurate is that you can't outrun a bad diet. And so especially in America, we have the standard American diet or SAD, for acronym. And, I think that already puts us at a big disadvantage. There's just so many ultra processed foods in America that are, stuffed with highly subsidized, high fructose corn syrup and other corn and related agricultural products that I think normally would not be shoved into these foods if the government wasn't incentivizing the farmers to produce a lot more of it. Specifically, I ended up choosing a ketogenic diet, and that was mainly because my research concluded that when your body goes into ketosis, you really supercharge your body processing fat as a store of energy, as opposed to normally it's going to be using carbohydrates to actually create your energy to power your metabolism. But Several years later, as I've tried a few other diets, I don't necessarily believe that keto is like the perfect diet for everyone. The reason why I think that it works for a lot of people, and the reason why I think it works for me, is really because it forces you to be mindful about what you're eating, and it forces you to avoid a lot of those ultra-processed foods. So, basically, on a ketogenic diet, it means I'm eating meat and vegetables, and maybe a little bit of fruit. But just that of cutting out a lot of the shelf stable products, I think is what really did it. That, along with cutting out beer and alcohol, you'd really want to avoid drinking your calories as well. And so mostly stick with coffee, black coffee, unsweetened tea, and a lot of water. And so that's another thing that I also started doing is, carrying around essentially a gallon jug of water that has my time of day markings on it, and making sure that I'm well hydrated. And I've done a little bit of fasting as well. I've tried intermittent fasting, I've tried multi-day fasting, and I think that that may be good for, sort of resetting your body, or can certainly be helpful for getting into ketosis if you're not already in it. Though I found that fasting while in ketosis is far easier. You generally don't get as hungry when your body is running on fat as its energy store. It's more of a slow burn type of thing. But point being with the drinking all of the water is that I found that just making sure that you're drinking a lot of water throughout the day also prevents you from getting hungry and wanting to snack because water, does help fill you up. And especially helps during fasting periods. But while I did all of this without specifically counting calories or looking at macros or anything else like that, I think that it was a sort of confluence of all of these other habits that resulted in me just naturally getting my caloric intake down and making sure that I was, burning a lot more than I was ingesting.
When you're talking about ketogenic diet, do you mean like there are two type, right? Like a high fat or a high protein one? Like which one are you talking about here?
So I was focused more on high fat at the time, since the fat was the my source of energy. I wasn't really tracking my macros or how much protein and fat I was getting at the time. That was something I started doing a few years later, though it's annoying. And I really only started tracking macros when I decided that I wanted to start adding more muscle. This early experiment with ketosis, I was primarily focused on losing fat, and that certainly worked. And I'd started going to the gym and w lifting weights, but not in any sort of highly regimented fashion. I didn't really know what I was doing. I didn't have any professional advice, or spend a ton of time, coming up with a weightlifting plan. I was just going in and, doing like three sets of max, on a variety of different, machines and whatever, just to make sure I was, actually working out my muscles. But I don't think I really gained much muscle during that. And what I realized after sort of being plateaued there for a couple of years and trying harder to gain muscle, I realized that on a ketogenic diet, it's very, very difficult to gain muscle because normally, in order to actually add muscle, you can't just eat protein. You also need carbohydrates to turn into, I think, glucose to help get your body into a position where it can start building up your muscles. That was, something that I started doing last year when I actually got a professional trainer, and they completely switched up my diet, which has led to a whole other journey over the past year.
What about the environment that you existed in at that time? Like, is it still the lockdown, COVID, and you are not going anywhere, or you were traveling around the world to Bitcoin conferences?
I think it wasn't until probably several months at least after I published that essay that we started having Bitcoin conferences again. And then, of course, trying to stay in a ketogenic diet while traveling and being on airplanes and stuff is also very difficult, especially when you go to Europe. There's a lot of breads and pastas and so on, and it can be probably almost as difficult to be vegetarian, trying to stick to meat and vegetables. But these days I'm not actually in ketosis. I'm sort of carb cycling in and out of low carb and high carb days, but not actually trying to keep my body in a state of ketosis.
What about the fasting that you mentioned there? Like, are you talking about complete fast or protein fasting?
Basically water fasting. I've done up to, I want to say, like 2.5 day fasts, just experimenting. Like I said, doing a 1 or a 2 day fast is a lot more doable, I think, when you're already in ketosis and just sticking to sort of water, tea, coffee. For me, one of the big improvements of being in ketosis, it just feels like I have more mental clarity, and don't get tired as easily. Like I said, it's more of like a slow burn rather than when you're eating sugars or carbs at a meal, that'll last for a little while, and then you'll kind of have a crash, and it's just more difficult to maintain your concentration and keep your general level of concentration and acuity managed. I have not gotten so far as to doing like a glucose, real-time glucose monitor. But one of the things that I have appreciated is sometime last year I got the Oura ring, and so I, that's primarily, for sleep tracking. It doesn't do as good of a job at tracking your sort of athletic metrics, but just from looking at the sleep tracking alone, I realized eating later at night, drinking alcohol in the evenings, these are things that impact your sleep quite negatively. And so, that has resulted in some more behavioral changes as well for me, and also just trying to stick to a more regularly scheduled time of going to sleep. Oura gives you these scores every day when you wake up, and I feel like they are generally accurate with just like sort of looking at how I feel myself, and I can tell, when I'm out too late, or if I'm even having like a single glass of wine or something with dinner, it has a noticeable impact on how well I sleep. And this is, it's sort of like I said at the very beginning, there's some very fundamental things here, like far more important than going to the gym, is what are you putting into your body? What are the inputs? If we're looking at our body as a just sort of type of a biological machine, obviously it's all about inputs and outputs. So, what food, what macros, what level of hydration are you getting? But also on the sleep side, how much and what level of quality is that sleep? If you don't have those really basic foundations, then pretty much anything else you do is going to it's not going to be as affected. And so I'm also, I mean, I've got a number of things in flight right now that I'm experimenting with, and one of them is I'm going to be trying out the 8 Sleep, which is basically a mattress cover to help regulate your temperature. As I'm a really hot sleeper, and especially during the summer, sometimes I've noted I get so hot that it'll wake me up in the middle of the night. So hopefully that's just like another thing to help bring more consistency to that aspect. Because if you consider you spend like 25 to 30% of your time sleeping, and that's a really important regenerative cycle for a variety of your biological processes every night. It's worth paying attention to.
Yeah, you might spend a month on that to actually figure out what's the right temperature for you at what time of the day, right? When sometimes you get up and go to toilet, that's when you okay, it's 1 a.m. and it's too cold. Then next day I'm gonna make it warmer. So, what the most important question? How many pills did you take in a day?
Well, that's a funny question because it's more related to an ongoing new experiment that I'm doing, right? During that first couple of years, I was only taking one or two pills. I was taking a ketogenic specific vitamin, which had things like magnesium and potassium. There are certain vitamins and minerals that ketogenic diets tend to be deficient on, and you want to make sure that you get plenty of those. So, I think I was taking that ketogenic vitamin and then maybe fish oil. But about a year ago, when I started messing around with some of these metabolic age tests and trying to look more on the longevity side of things, that's when my supplement intake exploded. I probably take over 20 pills a day at this point, and I have three or four different longevity focused companies that I am subscribed to, and I do sort of blood and stool testing to look at various markers. Some of it is for gut health, some of it the microbiome health, and then the rest of it is just looking at sort of metabolic health in general, trying to put a number on, is your metabolic age, higher or lower than your biological age? And I haven't really settled on how I feel about them yet, because, like I said, I'm doing like four different companies at the same time to see if they're even sort of in sync with each other. And a lot of this seems to be really early days, kind of hand wavy. The science is still a bit out there, unproven. So, I'm not at the point yet where I would necessarily point at any one thing and say, this is the way that you improve your metabolic health by just like taking a supplement. Obviously, I think that like drinking less alcohol helps. The weird thing is that some of these companies are really big on veganism and just like avoiding meat altogether, and that's very difficult for me. So
Red flag.
yeah, I don't know. I went through this whole cholesterol saga at the end of last year, where I was already having high cholesterol from being on a ketogenic diet, which is completely expected. But then what was unexpected was when I got a personal trainer and they completely changed my diet. It was basically 1 year ago, last summer. They changed my diet to high carb and ultra high protein diet. So it was around 100 grams of carbs a day and 200 grams of protein per day. And my cholesterol actually shot up even higher. And it was so high that my primary doctor wanted to put me on statins. And I have no history of heart issues, and I ended up having to go to a number of other doctors, cardiologists and lipid specialists, and basically determined that the simple cholesterol blood tests that doctors normally give you when you get an annual physical are not quite nuanced enough to give you a full picture of what's happening with your cholesterol and with your cardiovascular health. And basically, it's entirely possible to have a high LDL-C level, but to not have poor cardiovascular health. Having a high LDL-C could be a yellow flag, and it's worth looking into more. But I ended up having a CT scan of my heart to check, and I had a calcification score of 0 from that. So basically, I have no plaque buildup. And also, I got much more advanced lipid panels that do things like look at your apolipoprotein B, for example, and actually look at the size of your cholesterol particles. And the reason why those things are interesting is that if your cholesterol particle size is very large and fluffy, then that's generally considered safer. Whereas if you have a lot of really small particles, those particles are more likely to actually like pass through the cells of your blood vessels and get stuck. And that's when they can calcify, start to build up plaque. And of course, that is actually what we care about is preventing heart attacks. And heart attacks are a result of plaque building up and basically constricting your blood vessels. So short version is cholesterol is a very complicated thing, and you need to look at a variety of different markers. If you have no plaque buildup, then you need to look at additional cholesterol markers to get a better understanding of what is your actual risk. Is your cholesterol like the bad type that will, build up and cause plaque, or is it likely to just continue floating around your body and not cause you any problems?
Yeah, I just watched something about cholesterol today, and it's a kind of worms for sure. You also talked about SARMs. I'm not familiar with that. What's that?
Right. Is it selective androgenous receptor modulators or something like that? So SARMs, the best way to think of them is that they are compounds, they're molecules that are steroid-like. They help bind, to your muscles, your proteins, essentially to help encourage more muscle growth or sometimes fat loss. There's a variety of different SARM compounds out there. But it's the S, the selective part, that makes them more interesting than steroids. So, I'm not a doctor, but my understanding is, steroids is basically like blasting your whole body with this signal that just says, grow. Whereas SARMs are more specific in which cells in your body they're targeting. So you don't have the same level of risks and negative side effects of steroids, but they are riskier. SARMs are not approved by the FDA in the US. I'm not sure if they're approved by any other sort of government regulator authorities. They're in the US generally considered a gray market thing where you're not going to get a doctor to tell you to use SARMs, and purchasing them can be tricky because if you buy them, you basically have to agree that it's like not for human usage, like it's only for, experiments or something. So, also similar to steroids, it's not something that you want to stay on in perpetuity. Normally, you do like a 6 or an 8 week cycle, and then depending on the type of SARM that you're doing, there's certain post-cycle therapies that you might still want to like take various supplements because they can, for example, affect your testosterone levels. Not as badly as steroids, but there are still effects there. So I tried a couple of different SARMs, and they definitely work. I think the one that I found most effective was, sometimes it's called Ligandrol, sometimes it's called like LGD4. And I could tell when I was on it that I could generally feel like my heart racing more, and I just felt more energetic. I could like lift heavier weights when I was at the gym, and I think it did help, improve my fat loss and possibly, some addition of muscle while I was doing all of that. But I haven't done them since then, and in fact, I'm going to be trying something this summer with peptides, which I believe are, safer than SARMs, but once again, this is a sort of gray market, cutting edge area that's not like federally approved or anything like that. So, I will be reporting back on that, probably next year with the results.
Which peptides?
So the one that I'm looking at starting pretty soon is it's called Semirelin or Sermirelin. And that's one that is, specifically supposed to help both with adding muscle and reducing fat.
The GLP-1 agonists are, as all such peptides, new things. Had a bad experience with that. Turns out they raise, well, talking about ordering, your resting heart rate goes up significantly every single night, and your heart rate variability goes down. So I was trying to make it work, but I could not. And you know what's crazy, that it seems like the internet haven't even caught up to this. Like, only some Aura Reddit forums are talking about this. But when I was looking at like studies done, it was very consistently ruining the two things. Although, well, they certainly ruined my sleep, but on the other hand, there could be an argument made that even though it ruins the resting heart rate and heart rate variability, the actual health outcomes are positive. But, I'm not gonna test it on myself. I
Yeah, I
already
mean, a
did.
lot of these things seem to have trade-offs. There is no, magic pill or injection or whatever. I mean, I guess some people are playing around with like metformin and Ozempic and other stuff, but that's new enough that I'm kind of afraid that, 5 or 10 years from now, a lot of studies are going to come out about terrible long-term side effects of them.
That's why you have to take them while they are hot before the side effects appear. So a very interesting phenomenon in Bitcoin. Just yesterday, there is Max Hillebrand. There is a grill in the office, and what he does is he buys a lot of meat, like meat. And then makes a lot of meat on the grill, and then serves it. And here is your meat. No sides, no vegetables, no bread, no nothing.
Full
Here is your
carnivore.
meat. So what's going on? Why are Bitcoiners so fond of meat and carnivore?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't gone full carnivore myself. I guess the argument is that animal meat is like the most highly dense nutrient type of food that you can get out there. Because, in general, the animals that you're eating, they have been consuming hopefully grass and regular plants that are growing out of the ground so that they're essentially consuming a lot of the nutrients from the soil that are going into the plants that are rising up that are then being eaten and digested by the animals, and then so the animals and their meat themselves is a sort of higher order level of food as opposed to us trying to directly eat the plants ourselves and process that. There's some interesting arguments to it. I think we both know a number of people who have essentially been living on the carnivore diet for several years. I don't think I would really want to do that myself, for one, because I mean, I think you need fiber at the very least. You're gonna probably have some digestive issues, at least what I've read from other a number of people who did carnivore long term and then ended up stopping was usually due to various digestive issues that came up. But once again, this is the type of thing where I don't think that there's one diet that works for everyone. I did read an interesting book a year or two ago that I think it was basically called Eat Right for Your Type. And the author of that book made an argument that your blood type can actually be an indicator of like what the best type of diet for you is. And this is it is kind of hand-wavy science. It's more of a like almost archaeological or historical look at human civilization, and the arguments that they were making were, if you're this specific blood type, then your ancestors, probably came from Asia and were mostly used to eating these types of foods, and therefore your digestive system has evolved more to be, of that type of food. And I think it made sense, but once again, it's not necessarily like great peer-reviewed and tested science. But I will say that that book said that with my blood type, which is type O, that ketogenic diet works really well for people of blood type O, because we were historically more of the hunter-gatherer types. So societies that would be semi-nomadic. And mostly chasing animals, eating meat, and then also foraging for plants from time to time. Like I said, I think that people kind of need to experiment and figure out what's best for them. Everybody's body is different. And so this is why I don't go around saying, oh, everyone must eat ketogenic diet or everyone should be a carnivore or so on and so forth.
So, one of the most important question is, so everyone can lose weight, right? I lose weight like 3 times a year. I go down 10 kilogram, but then I always come back. So, and you aren't. So, how did that happen?
I think that it has to do with how strict you're willing to maintain whatever things you put in place. So, for me, the nice thing about keto was that I could basically eat whatever I wanted until I felt full. So eat a lot of meat and vegetables. If you're hungry, eat more, and that it generally was not going to add more fat to your body itself because your body is in fat processing mode. If you for whatever reason don't have the ability to stick to more strict regimens of diet and exercise, then it can be a lot more difficult, and it's not for everyone.
You
I
mean
think
you're
this is.
sticking to your diet for a very long time already, huh?
Yeah, also, as I think I stuck to that diet pretty strictly for 2.5, 3 years, up until a year ago. Now, I guess what I didn't mention, when I changed up my diet a year ago and I got the personal trainer, I gained a lot. But I was also trying to bulk up. That was the whole idea, was eating high carb, high protein, and adding a lot of muscle, but also added a decent amount of fat as a part of that process. So, now, once again, experimenting with trying other things where, right now, from a weight perspective and a body fat perspective, I am higher than I was, 18 months ago, and I'm still trying to improve of adding muscle and losing fat. So that's like one of the reasons why I'm looking into peptides to see, if they can help. It's very difficult to both add muscle and lose fat at the same time. Everybody wants to do that, but as I saw for the experiment with the last half of last year, when I added muscle, I also added a lot of fat. And I could cut, but I would be afraid that if I went back to my hardcore strict keto diet, yes, I would definitely lose muscle, but or I would lose fat, but I would probably also lose muscle. And that's one thing that I have noted amongst the people that I'm familiar with that stick to strict carnivore and strict keto diets. They tend to be pretty lean, not very high on the muscle side of things. It seems to me, just from sort of anecdotal experience, looking at my own body, looking at other people who are very strict about low carb diets, that if you are going to do that, it's going to be pretty difficult to have a higher level of muscle. And so, that's what I'm trying to go for right now. I did the lean thing for several years, and I just want to see, how can I reshape my body? I think this is kind of what any of us who are interested in health are trying to do, is we're just playing around with inputs and trying to figure out, what are the inputs that lead to these outputs. And I haven't found the perfect setup quite yet that is working for me, but there's a lot of different variables that you can play around with.
There is this training philosophy that maintenance is a myth. There is no maintenance. There is only cutting and working. Maintenance doesn't exist. It's just mentally too challenging. Another thing that you mentioned is the food. The food is getting worse. Now, there is an interesting theory here that inflation is making food worse, almost like directly, because there are these things, the prices are always sticky and they never want to go up. So instead of you, if you're selling a product and you have two choices, you either make your product as a food product more expensive on the shelves, or you can cut some corners. Maybe you can put some things in it that's bulking instead of the expensive ingredient, Bitcoin solves your diet as well, turns out.
Yeah, I mean, there's your shrinkflation. The package sizing is generally getting smaller while keeping the prices the same. And then there's just sort of the issue of fillers. For example, like we've even seen with a lot of the grated cheeses in America using basically cellulose, or in other words, plant material, and putting that into the cheese as a filler. And since I was pretty much avoiding a lot of processed foods, my actual grocery bill has gone up significantly, especially for the price of a steak. They can't really do any tricks to make steaks seem cheaper. They can't really cut them much smaller. It's very obvious. They can't really fill them with anything, and so the stakes that I was paying less than $20 for before the pandemic, I'm easily finding myself paying over $40 for today, and it's the cost of eating healthily, unfortunately.
I am actually wondering if you are familiar with the contrarian question of Peter Thiel.
Not off the top of my head.
So the idea is that things that very few people believe to be the case, and you believe strongly to be the case because your unique experiences made you see the evidence about a concept, about a thing, about anything. Now, those things are the most valuable because that's where you have that's where you are ahead of the market.
Yep.
So my question to you is, what is the thing that you strongly believe to be the case, but very few people agree with you on?
I mean, I normally would have said that was around Bitcoin, but that has, changed a fair amount over the past few years. I would say these days it's mostly privacy. It's almost nobody understands the value of privacy, probably because they haven't been sufficiently burned by it. This is just another thing that I track all of the time, or various data leaks. And if anything, the amount of information that seems to be getting leaked and passed around only seems to be increasing over the years. And so the question becomes, how are people going to react to that? And so far, it still doesn't seem to be bad enough that many people are putting effort into improving their privacy, or even thinking of it as like a security issue. So obviously, I'm well, both of us are f in a fairly unique situation in how we've been targeted, and so I think we understand it. And it's difficult, I think, to make other people believe that something like that could ever happen to them.
Yeah, privacy doesn't matter until it does. Also, it's not. I'm more worried about rather people not valuing highly their own privacy. They are trading it for all kinds of stuff. But what's problematic for me is that privacy development is getting criminalized,
Yep.
and like, how do you take care of your privacy when other people are not allowed to build privacy tools in the first place? Like, you have no options.
Yeah, I mean, part of the problem with privacy is that, let's see, how does the quote go? It privacy only extends so far as the cooperation of others in society, right? Privacy has a lot to do with, interacting with other people and doing so in such a way that, those interactions don't get broadcast to the rest of the world. But it's kind of reliant on both parties of the interaction, working to maintain that privacy and not leaking that information to the rest of the world.
So when you're sharing an information with someone else, right? But you can also consider privacy as an ability, your ability to selectively reveal yourself to the world. In that case, you remove the other party because the other party can do anything. They can try to breach your privacy like this, but you can't see me. You can't see me. I can go into the philosophy of privacy and talk a lot about it, but let me ask my final question to you. So, since we are both capitalists here, I assume, what is the value that you are bringing to the marketplace? What is that thing that people can pay money for you?
Yeah, I mean, at a high level, I provide security services. The fundamental point behind Bitcoin is, getting rid of trusted third parties. And unfortunately, a lot of people who come into the space, their sort of default journey is they sign up on an exchange, they buy some Bitcoin, and that's it. And so That's automatically putting people into a situation where they're dealing with trusted third parties. If this is the default, we're just recreating a different version of the banking system that happens to run on top of a blockchain. But where a lot of those interactions are just occurring in centralized databases. So I like to believe that I am helping to improve the ethos and the general decentralization of Bitcoin ownership, which will create just more robustness for the entire network and ecosystem. The sort of flip side, worst case situation that I want to avoid is one in which the vast majority of people who consider themselves Bitcoin owners are only owning IOUs in these centralized databases. And if a significantly large portion of Bitcoin ends up falling into the hands of a few custodians, there's potential governance issues there. There's potential systemic risk, against governments and nation states coming in and basically using those custodians as choke points. So from that perspective, I see it as adding value to Bitcoin overall just by us helping onboard more people into self-custody. And it's a convenience issue. The reason why I think people don't go into self-custody is because there's a learning curve, there's responsibility that you have to take on, and people are afraid that they're going to screw up and shoot themselves in the foot and they're going to lose all their money. So this is kind of going against the grain of human civilization in a sense, because we've built up civilization. Our society in general has scaled via trusted third parties, via outsourcing to specialists. The ability to specialize in doing one niche thing makes you much more effective, in general, and allows us to scale up organizations and to continue to progress our technology at an amazing rate, but it introduces fragility into the system. And we need to get more people to be willing to take on some responsibility to be their own bank. But I would say that Casa's primary goal is to reduce that learning curve, reduce the friction and the level of anxiety that comes with self-custody, because we basically help people avoid a lot of the foot guns, a lot of the ways that you can screw up just due to ignorance and naivete. And getting more people into a sort of assisted self-custody situation, I think, is going to be good for the entire ecosystem.
James Sonlop, Bitcoin developer, and from 2 days on, a fitness influencer. That was great. Thank you very much.
You bet. Thanks for having me.